So, as you probably have gathered, I came to Yeats young, like a lot of us do, young and sort of in love with that idea of him being in love with someone who wasn't in love with him back, and all the romantic strands of his poetry. But when I got into studying Irish literature in my master's and my PhD very deeply, I decided to go into the study of Irish women's writing because there was not very much of a legacy that I could see for Irish women's writing, just a few people out there. And I like that turn of the century period, the 1890 to 1916 period from the fall of Parnell to the Easter Rising. I just find it a really dynamic period for writing. I find it a really dynamic period of history, and I love the melding of the two. And so I looked into Irish women's writing, as I said. And one of the people that I came across was this woman, Catherine Tynan. And I found that I could not escape W.B. Yeats, William Butler Yeats. He was just there in the periphery of my vision. No matter what I did, he was there. He was there. He is the center of Irish literature. Not just, I would argue, not just during the period 1890 to 1916, not just during his lifetime, but he is still the Irish poet. Seamus Heaney might have a hold on us too, but in a different way. I think if you ask people from Ireland who their national poet is, who they would consider to be their national poet, they would choose William Butler Yeats. But Catherine Tynan was a very good friend of William Butler Yeats, a very close friend, particularly in the early days. She was a few years older than him. She got there first. She was a well-known poet before Yeats was even published. She was sort of the great hope of Irish poetry, and particularly Irish Catholic poetry, which, of course, Yeats was not. Yeats was not a Catholic poet. Yeats was an Anglo-Irish man, a conflicting position in and of its own right, just being Anglo and Irish at the same time. But Tynan knew him early on, and they wrote many, many letters back and forth, and they had a dream about Irish poetry that was shared with a lot of other people, a lot of other people. So he is there haunting the women's texts of the time, and he's there haunting most of Irish literature at the time. But what I'm here to talk to you about today is Yeats and belief. And what I'm going to suggest is that for Yeats, belief wasn't something that was just there for him to grasp and to say, this is what I believe in, this is what I know, this is what I'm going to believe in always. It was a constant struggle. It was a constant process of discovery. But I would suggest that there are three strands of belief that run through his writings in general and his poetry. And most of you probably know that he wrote much, much more than poetry. He wrote plays. He wrote lots and lots of journalism. He wrote lots and lots of prose works, including his own big philosophical tome, A Vision. But he has a recurring belief in himself and his art. And when I say belief, again, a struggle for belief in himself and his art. Okay. Sometimes he believes in himself to the point of arrogance. Sometimes he's very doubtful about himself. But he's struggling to believe in himself. And it's so, so central to his success as a poet and his importance in Irish poetry, that belief in himself and knowing that he needed to have it. He also struggles and discovers and equivocates about his belief in Ireland and those people he associated with her. And there were different people over the course of his lifetime. Some people remain there throughout, but some people he struggles with back and forth, believes they're good for Ireland, then perhaps believes maybe they're not so good for Ireland, then maybe drops them completely, as he did with Catherine Tynan. And then belief in something beyond the material world that runs through his poetry. And again, a struggle to figure out what that was and needing to believe that. And when I talk about that struggle, Yeats, at the beginning of his career, Tynan actually helped Yeats to secure his first publication in the Irish Monthly in the mid-1880s, mid to late 1880s. And then he began writing a book called The Wanderings of Usheen, which was based on Irish myth and folklore and the story of Usheen, which was eventually published in 1889. But in the midst of writing that book, which he went back and forth between believing in wholeheartedly and thinking was not very good, he wrote to Tynan this: "All seems confused, incoherent, inarticulate. Yet this I know, I am no idle poetaster. My life has been in my poems. To make them, I have broken my life in a mortar, as it were. I have brayed in it youth and fellowship, peace and worldly hopes. I have seen others enjoying while I stood alone with myself, commenting, commenting, a mere dead mirror on which things reflect themselves. I have buried my youth and raised over it a cairn of clouds." So really struggling with his belief in himself there, but not in his belief that he was a poet and he was going to get there someday. And dang if he didn't stick with it and got there. I wouldn't say that he got there in The Wanderings of Usheen. I'm not a big fan, but he did get there eventually. And all of this in 1889. Anybody know what year Yeats was born in? 1865, because we just had his 150th anniversary of his birth last month. So he was all of 24 at this point. Okay, so he's already buried his youth at the age of 24. But it's true, he did actually live in his poems. He was one of those kids who would walk into walls because he was so busy thinking of other things. You know, he was one of those kids from early on. His dad, John Butler Yeats, said he was a genius. Everybody else thought he was just a fool, a bit of a clumsy kid. He would do things like, even at this point in his life, he was doing things like wearing his Macintosh inside out. Somebody noticed him on the street in the pouring rain with his Macintosh inside out, and they said, you know, your Macintosh is on inside out, so he turns it right side up and puts it back on, soaking wet on the inside. He also did things like, Catherine Tynan talks about, she would have to, because all he did was talk to her about poetry, and she was trying to get on with things like picking out dresses and doing decorative work in her house and other things than poetry. She had a life other than poetry. Yeats did not. She would send him on errands because he used to go to her house, Whitehall, which was near Dublin, and stay for weeks at a time to talk poetry, poetry, poetry with her. But she would send him on errands just to get him out of the house. So she'd send him to the post office with letters, and the post office was 5 miles down the road. And she said she used to have to, after the first couple times when he got back without the letters and without having been to the post office and couldn't figure out where the letters had gone, she had to tie the letters to the bottom of the basket somehow. She had to secure them to the bottom of the basket. And on another instance, he had a very bad cold cough. She said he would forget. He would forget about things like eating, about things like, you know, remembering to wear socks with his shoes. All these things. So he would get ill from time to time, and he would work through his illness, work at poetry through his illness and not seem to notice it. But he was at the dinner table one night and he was coughing, 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 and someone gave him a box of cough drops. Cough lozenges, I suppose you'd call them. And he ended up eating the whole box in quick succession, not realizing that they were full of codeine, and slept for 30 hours thereafter. So Yeats, very, very sort of, you know, what are those? We all know somebody like this, don't we? But a genius. Now, he had a different lifestyle than most of us would have. Not really all that far off from James Joyce's, in that he was Anglo. Well, he wasn't, like, Joyce was Catholic Irish, but he grew up in a family where the father was a bit feckless, and he had his dad was trained as a lawyer, was called to the bar, had a family of children, and decided, no, I'm going to be an artist instead. And then ended up sort of not really wanting to complete any of his commissions. So there wasn't a whole lot of money in the house, but a very, very talented artist. He actually did the picture of Tynan there. And There, you can, if you can see the J.B. Yeats up there, 1887, and it's a lovely picture of her. It's absolutely spot on. There are pictures of her from the era, and it looks very much like her, but I think it captures something of her as well, something of her personality. She was a sweet, sweet person, perhaps a little too sweet to ever be completely successful as a poet. But Yeats's dad believed that Yeats, from a young age, was a genius, when nobody else did. He just saw something in his oldest son, and also believed that art was viable. And not many of us are raised in a household where art is a viable career. So Yeats grew up with a belief that he could be an artist of some sort, that was a laudable thing to do, that it was a practical thing to do, that it was also probably going to lead to him having some sort of money in the end. It was going to be okay, as long as he pursued his dream. And we get in that family a family of artists, okay? Not only William Butler Yeats, but also his younger brother Jack, who was a painter. Some of you may have seen some of Jack's paintings. And also his sisters, Lily and Lolly, not their real names, not a very nice thing to do to them, I don't think, to call them that. But they were lovely artists. They had their own printing press. They did tapestries. They worked with William Morris. Talented, talented family. Okay, and this comes out of a belief that art is viable, that you can do it and you can be successful at it. And Yeats was back and forth with success in the early years. Okay, so struggle and discovery. And Yeats made his discoveries relatively early on, or started to make his discoveries. He started to find his voice relatively early on. He was looking back on it in 1922. He said, about a period in 1890-ish, I had still the ambition formed in Sligo in my teens, and Sligo is that place in Ireland that Yeats returns to imaginatively in his mind over and over again. This is his dream Ireland. This is his perfection of Ireland. And it's the place where his mother's family, the Pollokspins, were from. And it's the place he visited as a child. So it's associated with those halcyon days, you know, of childhood and summers and things like that. I had still the ambition formed in Sligo in my teens of living in imitation of Thoreau on Innisfree, a little island in Lough Gill, and when walking through Fleet Street, very homesick, I heard a little tinkle of water and saw a fountain in a shop window, which balanced a little ball upon its jet, and I began to remember lake water. From the sudden remembrance came my poem Innisfree, my first lyric with anything in its rhythm of my own music. I had begun to loosen rhythm as an escape from rhetoric and from that emotion of the crowd that rhetoric brings. So becoming his own individual voice. And from to this point, Yeats very, very influenced by the Romantic poets, very influenced by the Romantic poets, very influenced as well by poets like Tennyson. Okay, so he's and Rossetti. Okay, so he's kind of copying, but here he begins to find his own voice. And when I was reading through Tynan's letters, I found an early version of Innisfree that he had scribbled down to her. And this is what it goes like. Most of you, I assume, know this poem. We'll read the final version next, but this is an early version of the poem. I will arise now, I will arise and go now, and go to the island of Innisfree, and live in a dwelling of wattles, of woven wattles and woodwork made. Nine bean rows, that's not my typo, that's Yeats's spelling. Some of you may know that Yeats was not a very good speller at all. Nine bean rows will I have there, a yellow hive for the honey bee, and this old care shall fade. There from the dawn above me, peace will come down, dropping slow, dropping from the veils of the morning to where the household cricket sings, and noontime there be all a glimmer, midnight be a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. Not far off from the final one, but we do see him really working on it and crafting it and making it a better poem, a much better poem, I think. When he tells that story in 1922, that is not at all far from looking in the shop window and seeing this little jet of water and with the ball on the end of it. It was for some sort of cooling drink, because at the time, Lily Yates writes of it in her letters, of him coming in and saying, I've got this poem. And it emerged fully formed from his head, and he recited it to his sisters, and they said, yes, that's it. That's what you're looking for. That's what you've been looking for. And of course, this is the poem from those early days that has lasted. The final version of the poem, 1890, goes like this. I will arise and go now, and go to Innisfree, and a small cabin build there of clay and wattles made. 9 bean rows will I have there, a hive for the honey bee, and live alone in the bee loud glade. And I shall have some peace there, for peace comes dropping slow, dropping from the veils of morning to where the cricket sings. There midnight's all a glimmer, and noon a purple glow, and evening full of the linnet's wings. I will arise and go now, for always night and day, I hear lake water lapping with low sounds by the shore. While I stand on the roadway or on the pavements gray, I hear it in the deep heart's core. If there's a more succinct or evocative image than the bee loud glade in any poetry, I haven't found it. I just think that is magical and it transports me every time, every single time. I'm in Sligo with Yeats. Now, he came to say that he came to apologize for this poem just a little bit late in life. I was listening to a BBC recording of him reading the poem in a strange sing-song voice, almost singing the poem. And he apologized for the fact that moonlight was all a glimmer and noon a purple glow. Not sure why he did that. Why was noon purple? No, but it's hard to imagine it. Otherwise, you can't really say noon's all a glimmer and midnight a purple glow doesn't scan as well. I'm sure that had something to do with it. And he apologized for the last stanza as well. He said, I would not write that one now. It's going just a little bit too far. So still a process, even late in life when he was reading out these poems for the BBC, rewriting, and actually physically rewriting some of them too. I mean, he changed the first line of one of his poems before he read it, and people were not very happy because by that time they knew it very, very well. One of the things that Yeats loved about poetry, believed in terms of poetry as a form, was its malleability. The way it could be changed and constantly worked on, almost like a piece of clay, just over and over again, shaping it till he got it right or close to right. So he believed in playing with poetry as much as possible. And we see him doing it over and over again in poems. And this is one that he worked on from 1892 to 1925. And we can see through the process of the two poems the growth of Yeats as a poet. So let me just read these out to you, and maybe we can talk just a little bit about what's going on here, what's changed, and perhaps why. So the first version, The Sorrow of Love. The quarrel of the sparrows in the eaves, the full round moon and the star-laden sky, and the loud song of the ever-singing leaves, had hid away earth's old and weary cry. And then you came with those red mournful lips, and with you came the whole of the world's tears, and all the sorrows of our laboring ships, and all the burdens of her myriad years. And now the sparrows warring in the eaves, the crumbling moon, the white stars in the sky, and the loud chanting of the unquiet leaves are shaken with earth's old and weary cry. And then the 1925 version. The brawling of a sparrow in the eaves, the brilliant moon and all the milky sky, and all that famous harmony of leaves had blotted out man's image and his cry. A girl arose that had red, mournful lips, and seemed the greatness of the world in tears, doomed like Odysseus and the laboring ships, and proud as Priam murdered with his peers. Arose and on the instant clamorous eaves, a climbing moon upon an empty sky, and all that lamentation of the leaves could but compose man's image and his cry. For any of you, any significant changes there? Anything that you... He has, hasn't he? Yeah. That's a good question, and I don't know for certain, to be honest. I think he always preferred the version that he was working on, and maybe they were always a work in process. You know, for him, because he did believe he could return to them and play around with them. Once they were out there and published, they weren't necessarily sacred. So, yeah. Well, whether he was ever quite over Maud Gonne or his image of Maud Gonne is open to question, but definitely he was in the throes of it here. He was in, and we'll get on to Maud Gonne in just a minute, but yes. And here very much a particular woman. And then here a girl arising.
So in fact, could you say that because there's 25 years have passed and there's a lot of changes going on in his experience of psychology, they are in fact two different poems?
Yes, I would say so. I would say so. I think the inspiration there and perhaps the moment of inspiration might be the same, but the poems are quite different.
She's quite keen to get in Odysseus and try a reference to the classical world.
Yes. Yes, yes, and of course, Priam. You know, he had a fascination with the whole story of Troy. So very, very much a passion for him. Yeah, and we get the difference between the quarrel and the brawling, and the quarrel of the sparrows, plural, and the brawling of a sparrow seems to me significant. And what do you take away from that? What do you make of that? Between crumbling and climbing, quite different images. So perhaps a more optimistic. And during the First World War, of course, Yeats, a famous, you know, dissenter, he was not pro World War I at all. No, not pro Easter Rising either. Despite, you know, he didn't like violence very much. Maybe, unless he's having a fight with himself. So. Yeah. The brawling of a sparrow. I find that a really striking image, actually. Do you have a preference? Anybody have a preference?
I like the first one better.
Do you like the first one better? Why?
It's more personal. It's more moving.
Yeah. And yet it does suggest Yeats's distance from that moment.
Oh, yeah.
and looking back from that moment and reflecting very differently on it later in life. Yeah. Okay, I want to move on now to his belief in Ireland and those associated with her. And as I say, when I say belief, I mean that he wants very much to believe in Ireland and doesn't always. Okay, doesn't always believe that Ireland's headed in the right direction. Doesn't always believe that the people he wants to believe in are headed in the right direction. But he believes very much in himself in relation to Ireland. And he sets himself up as the center. Early on, he sets himself up as the center of an Irish literary movement. More of a collaborative effort than he later lets on. But certainly he emerges very quickly as the leader of that movement and the person who everybody looks to, even when they don't agree with him. Okay. So Yeats again writing to Tynan on the 10th of October, 1889, just to show how central Ireland is even at this early date in Yeats's vision of poetry. He says to Tynan, "When you write, always tell me what you are writing, especially what poems. The journalism interests me more dimly, of course, being good work for many people, but no way, unless on Irish matters, good work for you or me. Much may depend in the future on Ireland, now developing writers who know how to formulate in clear expressions the vague feelings now abroad, to formulate them for Ireland's, not for England's use." Those vague feelings now abroad were the burgeoning nationalist movement in Ireland. It's always been there. There was 500 years of repression, and it always been there, but it was really, really growing towards the end. And we get it growing for lots of different reasons. We get it growing in particular at this period in time, partly because there were other people in Europe doing the same thing. A guy named Giuseppe Mazzini was over in Italy saying that, Venice didn't belong to Austria. Venice actually belonged to the rest of Italy. And we get people arguing that a nation is very, very different than just the lines that people in power draw, that what makes a nation are its folklore and its practices and its games and its art and those sorts of things. Not the people who rule it and decide where the lines go, but the people who live in it and decide who they belong to. So nations as imagined communities, to borrow Benedict Anderson's phrase. But Yeats very much wanting to work on behalf of Ireland and to say that Ireland has its own literature and I am a part of it. And then not only that he is a part of it, but also that he is up there with the greats, up there with the greats. And then later on, reflecting back on this in his Nobel Prize lecture, when he won it in 1923, saying, "The modern literature of Ireland, and indeed all that stir of thought which prepared for the Anglo-Irish War, began when Parnell fell from power in 1891. A disillusioned and embittered Ireland turned away from parliamentary politics. An event was conceived, and the race began, as I think, to be troubled by that event's long gestation." And that event was the Easter Rising in 1916, which, as he said, eventually led to the Anglo-Irish War and the forming of the Free State of Ireland in 1922. Interesting. For those of you who don't know, he refers to Mr. Hyde there. Anybody know who Mr. Hyde was? Douglas Hyde. Okay, Douglas Hyde eventually becomes the first president of Ireland. But at the time, Douglas Hyde is a friend of Yeats. They're all sort of forming around a group from Trinity College Dublin and some other people who are involved in the Irish language movement and the poetry movement and things like that. Yeats himself got nowhere near Trinity College Dublin. He couldn't pass the entrance examinations, much to his father's disappointment. His father was a TCD graduate. Yeats never went to college himself. He ended up in art school. He ended up in art school with some really very dynamic people, including a man named George William Russell, more famously known as A.E., who was very much a mystic, spiritualist person, very influenced by Blake, William Blake, both of them in the Romantics. He gets involved early on with all these people who eventually become these really big people. So it's an incredibly dynamic group of young people emerging at this time. So go on, continue with the quote. Mr. Hyde founded the Gaelic League, where songs were sung and stories told in the Gaelic language. Meanwhile, I had begun a movement in English. Yeats couldn't speak Gaelic. So very much setting himself up as the center, but this may seem like Yeats sort of imposing a retrospective view of his importance, but no, not really. It's an interesting thing with Yeats that not only did he believe that he was going to be the center of Irish literature, but that he did become the center of Irish literature. And even at that time, you know, people are writing about him. Even in 1893, 1894, people are writing about him as the center of that movement and saying yes, and that they had leapt into, that group of people had leapt into that void filled by politics. They had predefined it as an era in which they were going to do great things with art that couldn't be done in the realm of politics. Okay, now we get on to Maud Gonne, 1866 to 1953. He met Maud Gonne in January of 1889. It was the same month that he published his first book of poetry, The Wanderings of Oisin. Not by accident. I'm sure she sought him out because he had written this book of poetry. He was living in London in Bedford Park at the time, and he wrote about that this. I was 23 years old when the troubling of my life began. She drove up to our house in Bedford Park with an introduction from John O'Leary to my father, and John O'Leary, the famous Fenian, precursor of the Irish Republican Brotherhood and later the Irish Republican Army, who had been exiled for many years from Ireland and a good friend of Yeats. I had never thought to see in a living woman so great beauty. It belonged to famous pictures, to poetry, to some legendary past. A complexion like the blossom of apples, and yet the face and body had the beauty of lineaments, which Blake calls the highest beauty because it changes least from youth to age, and a stature so great that she seemed of a divine race. Anybody know how tall Maud Gonne was? Nearly 6 feet tall. The men I know don't tend to agree with me. I think she's absolutely gorgeous, absolutely stunning. Obviously, Yeats agreed with me. I read something not too long ago, and I can't for the life of me remember who said it. But I think it might have been Dorothy Parker even. But after Yeats had died, said that Yeats loved big Amazonian women. He would have loved Vanessa Redgrave with her giant hands, and he definitely loved Maud Gonne, or a version of Maud Gonne. She didn't end up being quite the person, but man, he stuck by her. You know, he kept recreating her in his poetry. So Maud Gonne, as Norma Jeffers says, brought into Willie Yeats' life an overpowering tumult. He realized they were seeking different ends. She thought almost any means justified if the ends were successful. He thought only the means could justify the end. She spoke to him of her desire for power. He spoke to her of his spiritual philosophy. Maud Gonne set herself up as the Joan of Arc of Ireland. She wanted to lead Ireland to freedom. Anybody know what Maud Gonne's background was? She was the daughter of a British Army officer stationed in Ireland. She didn't have a whole lot of connection to Ireland, but fell madly in love with it. She was about 16, living there. But she lived mostly elsewhere, as did Yeats a lot of the time, actually. She lived a lot in Paris. He lived a lot in London. Neither one of them living a whole lot of time in Ireland. But during both of them, during their formative years. Right. So I think you know, this is what always captures my students' imagination, is this unrequited love from Montgomery, and those poems that deal with that. Okay, and then very, very important to Yeats was this belief in something beyond the material world. He said about it, Yeats very much needed to believe in something beyond the material world. His father was an atheist, didn't need those sorts of things, but Yeats did. I think he needed to know that there was something else. He was a very isolated child. He was his father's favorite son and his mother's least favorite. She wasn't keen on her oldest son, and but his father was. And so there was always this struggle within him. I think being a poet, he wanted there to be more to the world. He wanted to be more than there to be more than the material. And he wanted, but he was also very, very interested in science, very good at science, actually. So he wanted proof as well. And he went out and searched for it. But what he said about it was that he believed in three doctrines which have, as I think, been handed down from early times and been the foundations of nearly all magical practices. These doctrines are, number one, that the borders of our mind are ever shifting and that many minds can flow into one another, as it were, and create or reveal a single mind, a single energy. That the borders of our memories are as shifting, and that our memories are a part of one great memory, the memory of nature itself. And that this great mind and great memory can be evoked by symbols. I won't pretend that I understand all of Yeats' symbology, but I will try to introduce you to one thing. He was very much... important symbols to him are the rose, okay, which is fairly easy to understand. The rose is something akin to perfect beauty, in all the meanings of the word beauty, and also the cross, okay. And he was a Rosicrucian. He was also a theosophist. He was also a member of the Order of the Golden Dawn. He went to seances. He did lots of different things to try to find that proof that he was looking for of something beyond the material world. But here's the one I'm going to try. Well, you might be able to explain gyres to me more than I can explain gyres to you. I'm going to use Yeats' own words and see if we can figure out what he's on about. Okay? But he had this theory about gyres, borrowed from other people, but he certainly wrote... in depth about it in his book A Vision from 1925 and in other places. Gyres are basically cones, cylinders, with a wide opening at one end and a narrow opening, a bit like an ice cream cone, one within the other. And they're working at the same time and against each other through processes of history and in individual people themselves. So that at death, in individual people, something is revealed, either a point of focus or a point of expansion, okay, that you're either moving outward from the self or inward towards a better understanding of the self through your life. History's also working in the same way. So here's one way that he explained this. You see here we have a shaded cone and an unshaded cone. And he says, if I call the unshaded cone discord and the other concord and think of each as the bound of a gyre, I see that the gyre of concord diminishes as that of discord increases, and can imagine after that the gyre of concord increasing while that of discord diminishes, and so on, one gyre within the other always. Not really all that different than Eastern philosophies about the yin and the yang, okay? Forces moving and opposing each other as necessary, depending on the circumstances. And another, talking about gyres. This figure is true also of history. For the end of an age, which always receives the revelation of the character of the next age, is represented by the coming of one gyre to its place of greatest expansion, moving out, and of the other to that of its greatest contraction. And he believed this. He believed that we were in the process of an expansion. Okay? At the present moment, the life gyre is sweeping outward, unlike that before the birth of Christ, which was narrowing to that point of origin, Western world narrowing to that point of origin of Christ, and has almost reached its greatest expansion. The revelation which approaches will, however, take its character from the contrary movement of the inner gyre. Anybody? Is it making any kind of sense?
It's like paradigm theory.
Like paradigm theory? In what way?
Well, they anomalies in one paradigm lead to the birth of the next.
Right. Yeah. And he talked about, like I said, Troy, the history of Troy, very much an important thing to him than the birth of Christ. And, you know, he talks about how when one empire falls, another rises in its place. So you get a point of narrowing and expansion.
The gyre is the ascent of a hawk.
Mm.
Because he talks about a burn in a jar, peregrine rising.
Yes, and take some of that, too, from images from Dante and things like that, of similar images of rising out of hell and things like that, yes. We're going to get to it, yeah, shortly, here. Yeah. Oh, okay, there we go. Now, I'm going to have you read some poems. I had no idea there would be quite so many people here, so I did 15 handouts. Okay, so what I'm going to do is just pass out what I've got, and I'll just read out the poems, and we'll see what we can do with them. If you wouldn't mind sharing. Okay, so I've included a few more quotes, but let's turn to the first poem on the handout, which is "To Ireland in the Coming Times." From 1893. Again, early on in Yeats's career, when he was still quite a young man, still in his 20s, him talking about his place as an Irish poet. So reflecting his own belief in himself and other things. I'll read it out to you. Know that I would accounted be true brother of a company that sang to sweeten Ireland's wrong, ballad and story, ran and song. Nor be I any less of them because the red rose bordered hem of her whose history began before God made the angelic clan, trails all about the written page. When time began to rant and rage, the measure of her flying feet made Ireland's heart begin to beat. And time bade all his candles flare to light a measure here and there. And may the thoughts of Ireland brood upon a measured quietude. Nor may I less be counted one with Davis, Mangan, Ferguson, because to him who ponders well, my rhymes more than their rhyming tell of things discovered in the deep where only bodies laid asleep. For the elemental creatures go about my table to and fro, that hurry from unmeasured mind to rant and rage in flood and wind. Yet he who treads in measured ways may surely barter gaze for gaze. Man ever journeys on with them after the red rose bordered hem. All fairies dancing under the moon, a druid land, a druid tune. While still I may, I write for you, the love I lived, the dream I knew. From our birthday until we die is but the winking of an eye, and we are singing and our love, what measurer time has lit above, and all benighted things that go about my table to and fro. Our passing on to where may be in truth's consuming ecstasy, no place for love and dream at all, for God goes by with white footfall. I cast my heart into my rhymes that you, in the dim coming times, may know how my heart went with them after the red rose bordered hem. And if you just wouldn't mind having a chat with your neighbors about what strikes you about this poem, what may be going on, and what Yeats is professing a belief in here, and a struggle for belief in here, but also, you know, that symbol of the rose, that image of the red rose bordered hem, what do you think he's getting to there? Do you have any idea? Oh, thank you. Apologies, I didn't mean to miss you.
I'm not sure. Thank you.
How many of you have come across this poem before? Those of you who have come across it before, has it stuck with you for a reason? Is there anything about it that you particularly like? Yeah.
It's difficult where I always have to get to understand the whole Rosicrucian thing. I don't think people know enough about the Rosicrucian to get the red rose body image.
Yes. Well, I mean, in terms of the red rose, I've heard it, and read about it being analyzed as a variety of different things. You know, the rose very important as well to Ireland and a symbol of Ireland. And we get, you know, the Rosin dove, the black rose, as a symbol of Ireland. But it also is that point of perfection, that point of aesthetic, in particular aesthetic beauty. And also, I've had students argue persuasively about the idea of being bordered in as well, within something, and the rose's relationship to England. So we can look at it in a variety of different ways.
It's also very feminine. I mean, the hem depends on dress, and while it is a lot about Ireland, the stanza, "While sky may I write for you," it's more gone that comes into my mind. And I know he sees her as an image of Ireland itself.
And he did, you know, he did admit later in life that even though she had brought this tumult into his life, and that you know, that his writing was a constant process of trying to explain himself to her, so that he wouldn't have been the artist he ended up being had he not had that tumult, that challenge that she presented. Yeah.
I always like the idea of, may I be counted one of them, this idea of a group of presumably other artists and poets and people who cared for Ireland. And the whole thing about, I mean, I always read it as like the Celtic revival of interest in Ireland's myths and stories and heritage way back before England were able to do that. But I like that, I like the way you count me in with these other people.
Right? Yeah, and he mentions those three people in particular, yeah. Davis Mangan and Ferguson, who were of a generation before him, but very much nationalist poets, so writing on behalf of Ireland, for Ireland again.
So was Maud gone a kind of muse to him? Like Robert Graves had muses.
Absolutely. Maud Gonne was the muse, really. I mean, he did have other loves, and certainly other lovers, not the least of whom was... he had formed a very passionate attachment later in life to Maud Gonne's daughter, Isolde, which is a bit creepy. But yeah, I mean, he was very much in love with, or believed himself to be in love with Isolde. And if you see pictures of Isolde, you can see why. She's a stunning girl. But, you know, she was very, very much younger than him. And when he got married, he was actually still in love with, or believed himself to be in love with Isolde, still infatuated with Isolde, and did ask her to marry him. And was refused.
Can I just comment on the poem?
Yes, absolutely.
To me, it sums up Yeats as a poet, really, because you've got this romantic stream coming through, which is the poetic stream, but you've got the political side as well.
Mm.
And I think that's what makes Yeats so relevant and so interesting, the poet, that he engages us because we are engaged both with the the romantic side, but also we're in the world, so we're engaged in politics.
Mm.
And Yeats here tries to marry those two together, doesn't he? And I think that's the theme that runs, the struggle runs through all his poetry, and what makes it exciting still to read, you know, 100 years later. It's still exciting to read because we're all engaged in that struggle, our own personal lives and our lives in society, in politics.
And it would have been a much less interesting struggle as well had there not been that challenge of him both being Anglo-Irish, for one thing, so that, you know, he knew that he was working for a process that might very well exclude him from the country. I mean, you know, when we think of the Sinn Féin movement, for instance, you know, the Sinn Féin movement becoming so strong in the early 20th century that people wouldn't even buy, you know, boots that were made in England. You know, they were just refusing any... you know, nationalism bordering on you know, fascism, really, you know, dangerous versions of nationalism, but still necessary at the time. They were serving a purpose. Maud Gonne, if Yeats had fallen in love with some passive beauty, who had no ambitions of her own, he would be a far less interesting poet as well. And I think that what he loved about her, what he believed himself in love with about her, was that she was this force, and she had the courage of her convictions as well. You know, she did more than she became an icon for more than Yeats.
Do you ever wonder what if?
What if?
She had.
Chances are she did once, at least in 1908. But no. Yeah, I mean, I think it's a he's a better poet for that being unconsummated for such a long time.
He said he might have been content to live if she had said yes.
Yeah. And does contentment breed good poetry?
No, I didn't ever think of a dress with a hem. For me, the hem was a shroud.
Ah.
And the shroud has the Rose of England on it.
Mm.
Oh, see, the red rose.
I grew up
in and that would not be out of keeping with Yeats either. That idea of blood, and you know, we get later on the blood dim tide is loosed, and it's just such an odd image though. In a poem that's full of little odd images, that's the big one and the recurring one, and I still struggle with it. Still struggle with it. But that he's professing at this early point in his life that I want to be a national poet. I want to be a nationalist poet, and I want to be a national poet. And like I said, goes out there and does it. I find that absolutely fascinating. Okay, let's move on to a couple of Gonne poems, Maud Gonne poems. At two different points... I just want to read out a quote from Yeats, writing in a diary entry in 1908 about Maud Gonne. He wrote, "Today the thought came to me that P-I-A-L, which is Maud Gonne, a nickname for her from her Order of the Golden Dawn name, never really understands my plans or nature or ideas. Then came the thought, what matter? How much of the best I have done and still do is but the attempt, I said before, to explain myself to her. If she understood, I should lack a reason for writing, and one can never have too many reasons for doing what is so laborious." Okay. So, a very famous poem that I'm sure you all know, When You Are Old, from 1893. When you are old and gray and full of sleep and nodding by the fire, take down this book and slowly read and dream of the soft look your eyes had once and of their shadows deep. How many loved your moments of glad grace and loved your beauty with love false or true? But one man loved the pilgrim soul in you and loved the sorrows of your changing face. And bending down beside the glowing bars, murmur a little sadly how love fled and paced upon the mountains overhead and hid his face amid a crown of stars. And then, in juxtaposition to that, No Second Troy from 1910. Why should I blame her that she filled my days with misery, or that she would of late have taught to ignorant men most violent ways, or hurled the little streets upon the great, had they but courage equal to desire? What could have made her peaceful with a mind that nobleness made simple as a fire, with beauty like a tightened bow, a kind that is not natural in an age like this, being high and solitary and most stern? Why, what could she have done, being what she is? Was there another Troy for her to burn? Yeats, in many ways, created Gone. And not because she didn't have an idea of herself. She had a very firm idea of herself. But in the public imagination, his poems were famous in his lifetime. So she became the Countess Kathleen. She became Kathleen Nehoulihan in his plays. She was the personification of Ireland for many people. She might not have been quite as successful at that had she not had Yeats at her backing, writing these beautiful things for her and about her. But he was very aware later in his life that the image that he had created of her was not the person that she actually was, and that he had very much fallen in love with his own vision of who Maud Gonne was. Evidence of that he had no idea that she was, shortly after he met her, became pregnant and had a child, wrote about her as this virginal presence for quite a while after that. So we get in When You Are Old, this early version of her, and later on in No Second Troy, a different version of her. But what I would ask you about these two poems is that idea of Maud Gonne diminished at all between those two poems?
The moment school children mentions when he's a senator and he's walking through the school and he tries to imagine her as the child, sees a child in front of him and wonders, was she like that? And his mind is driven wild in this image. So he's competing as an old man, he's competing as a child.
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. Is there ever, now this is a much more abstract question, is there ever an early love that isn't founded on some sort of myth? Do we not all do some mythologizing? And maybe that's our connection to these poems. Maybe we are there, and then we live with a person for, not talking about anybody in particular, but for 33 years, and they, they're still wonderful, but they're wonderful in a very different way. You learn all the complexities and all those things that aren't quite what you expected them to be. And this very much was a marriage of a different kind. I mean, they called it an astral marriage. They called it, you know, they believed they were united. It was a good way for Maud Gonne to say, yeah, no, I really don't want to have sex with you. But it was also very much a meeting of the minds at a certain point. At a certain point, they did very much differ on the violence. On the need for violence and the way that Ireland could achieve what they both knew she needed to achieve. So let's look a little more closely now at Ireland in two poems. And again, points of struggle, points of discovery. So the first one is a struggle poem, the second one about a reflection poem where sort of where he discovers something that but that he knows, but it's made manifest to him. So the first one is September 1913. Now this poem, I'm sure somebody here knows what was going on in September of 1913. Sorry? Yeah, the great lockout in Dublin when the business owners were locking out the laboring classes who were not being treated very well. So, he writes, "What need you, being come to sense, but fumble in a greasy till, and add the halfpence to the pence, and prayer to shivering prayer, until you have dried the marrow from the bone, for men were born to pray and save. Romantic Ireland's dead and gone, it's with O'Leary in the grave." Yet they were of a different kind, the names that stilled your childish play. They have gone about the world like wind, but little time had they to pray, for whom the hangman's rope was spun, and what, God help us, could they save? Romantic Ireland's dead and gone, it's with O'Leary in the grave. Was it for this the wild geese spread the grey wing upon every tide, for this that all that blood was shed, for this Edward Fitzgerald died, and Robert Emmett and Wolfe Tone, all that delirium of the brave? Romantic Ireland's dead and gone, it's with O'Leary in the grave. Yet could we turn the years again and call those exiles as they were, in all their loneliness and pain, you'd cry, some woman's yellow hair has maddened every mother's son. They weighed so lightly what they gave, but let them be, they're dead and gone, they're with O'Leary in the grave. And those of you who don't recognize the names there, I think can recognize the tone of that poem. But could somebody just tell me, anybody know what the wild geese refers to?
Well, it was the 18th century rebellion. I don't remember the details, but they were exiled after the rebellion.
The Ulster Earls.
Okay.
Who left Ireland because of the, initially when Elizabeth came to the throne, so it would have been, I think, 17th century, they left from County Donegal because they felt the English were bringing in others to take their lands, and they were not prepared. The Crown would allow them to keep their lands if they were subservient to the Queen and held them from the Queen, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
But she and subsequent leaders of England were not happy to go along with allowing them to retain their ancient earldoms. And so they, although they were made earls by the Queen, and then they realised what they were going to lose, so they went off to France.
And Spain, yes. And it's been a thing that's been done ever since. But the wild geese, yes, that refers to the flight of the wild geese refers to those people who were not willing to compromise their principles and so chose to leave Ireland forever rather than to compromise, to live under the rules of the Queen. Yeah. Edward Fitzgerald, Robert Emmett, Wolfe Tone. Anybody know those names? I'm sure.
Old martyrs.
Yeah. Yeah, 1798 rebellion, along with the French failed rebellion. So what is Yeats in that first stanza in particular? What is Yeats complaining about? Do you think who is Yeats complaining about? Do you have any idea? What need you, being come to sense, but fumble in a greasy till, and add the halfpence to the pence, and prayer to shivering prayer, until you have dried the marrow from the bone?
The businessman, as you referred to, who had closed the businesses down, and caused the great Dublin lockout.
Mm. And particularly here, he removed a line about flickering candles that would have given a sense of Catholicism to this, and these middle class Catholic business owners were really the subject of his ire here, adding that halfpence to the pence, money grubbing, and that figure of John O'Leary there as that romantic patriot of the past, very, very genteel rebel, John O'Leary. Very genteel rebel. Okay. Now let's go to 1937, to the end of Yeats's life, to the Municipal Gallery Revisited. Yeats explained about the genesis of this poem. What he wrote about it was, "For a long time I had not visited the Municipal Gallery. I went there a week ago and was restored to many friends. I sat down after a few minutes, overwhelmed with emotion. There were pictures painted by men, now dead, who were once my intimate friends. There were portraits of my fellow workers. There was that portrait of Lady Gregory by Mancini, which John Singh thought the greatest portrait since Rembrandt. There was John Singh himself. There, too, were portraits of our statesmen, the events of the last 30 years in fine pictures. Ireland not as she is displayed in guidebook or history, but Ireland seen because of the magnificent vitality of her painters in the glory of her passions. For the moment, I could think of nothing but that Ireland, that great pictured song." And he writes this absolutely beautiful poem about that visit. "Around me the images of 30 years, an ambush, pilgrims at the waterside, casement upon trial half hidden by the bars, guarded, Griffith staring in hysterical pride. Kevin O'Hagan's countenance that wears a gentle, questioning look that cannot hide, a soul incapable of remorse or rest, a revolutionary soldier kneeling to be blessed. An abbot or archbishop with an upraised hand blessing the tricolor. This is not, I say, the dead Ireland of my youth, but an Ireland the poets have imagined, terrible and gay. Before a woman's portrait, suddenly I stand, beautiful and gentle in her Venetian way. I met her all but 50 years ago for 20 minutes in some studio. Heart smitten with emotion, I sink down, my heart recovering with covered eyes. Wherever I had looked upon my permanent or impermanent images. Augusta Gregory's son, her sister's son, Hugh Lane, only begetter of all these, Hazel Lavery living and dying, that tale as though some ballad singer had sung it all." Mancini's portrait of Augusta Gregory, greatest since Rembrandt, according to Singh, a great ebullient portrait, certainly, but where is the brush that could show anything of all that pride and that humility? And I am in despair that time may bring approved patterns of women or of men, but not that selfsame excellence again. My medieval knees lack health until they bend, but in that woman, in that household where honor had lived so long, all lacking found. Childless, I thought, my children may find their deep-rooted things, but never foresaw its end. And now that end has come, and I have not wept. No fox can foul the lair the badger swept. An image out of Spenser and the Common Tongue. John Singh, I, and Lady Gregory thought all that we did, all that we said or sang must come from contact with the soil. From that contact, everything, Antaeus like, grew strong. We three alone in modern times had brought everything down to that soul test again. Dream of the noble and the beggar man. And here's John Singh himself, that rooted man, forgetting human words, a grave, deep face. You that would judge, do not judge alone, this book or that. Come to this hallowed place where my friends' portraits hang and look thereon, Ireland's history in their lineaments trace. Think where man's glory most begins and ends, and say my glory was I had such friends. Maud Gunn, no doubt an important presence or absence in Yeats's life, but perhaps nothing in comparison to Lady Augusta Gregory, who made him possible in as many ways, in as many practical ways as she possibly could. She had the house, Cool Park, that he returned to imaginatively again and again. The Wild Swans at Cool, beautiful poem about love and loss and the west of Ireland, which he loved so much. And Lady Gregory and J.M. Singh formed that part of his life that was the Abbey Theatre, and that was very, very important to him too. In fact, by the time he got to his Nobel Prize speech, he felt that that part of his life was more important than his poetry. How many of you have ever seen a Yeats play performed? Which did you see?
I can't remember.
Yeah. Was that the Abbey? How about you? Countess Kathleen. In his poem The Man and the Echo, Yeats has a line, did that play of mine send out certain men the English shot, talking about Easter 1916, Easter Rising in 1916, and the fact that his play Kathleen the Houlihan had been known to make rebels, really. It was actually being revived in the Abbey Theatre that week, Easter week, or it was supposed to be revived. The posters were up everywhere, and of course, when Easter Monday happened and so much devastation occurred, the plays were cancelled. It seems an arrogant question in retrospect, but those plays that they staged at the Abbey, maybe not Yeats's so much. I don't think he was a great playwright. And certainly my favorite of his plays, Kathleen Ni Houlihan, was actually written primarily by Lady Gregory, uncredited early on. She's now credited for the most part. But certainly he had such a strong tie to the Abbey Theatre, and he did defend John Singh, J.M. Singh, so much when the Playboy riots occurred, and later Sean O'Casey when there were problems around the Plough and the Stars. So that very much an important part of his life. And so these two people coming in there at the end of this poem, being focused on so very much Augusta Gregory and John Singh, central as well to him, but certainly Augusta Gregory, who had the money that allowed him to keep writing poetry when otherwise he might not have, and also who had that wonderful, wonderful house. Have you come across this poem before? The Hugh Lane, yes. Oh, did they really? That would be fascinating. That would be absolutely fascinating. I was just there last year. Nothing like that in the Hugh Lane. But I was looking for all those John Butler Yeats portraits that I know they have there, but they most of them must be tucked away somewhere. I'd love to see more of those in person. But a lovely poem, and this a poem we can grasp, and this a poem we can look up all these references to Kevin O'Higgins and maybe some of those names that are not as well known to some of you. You probably know who Kevin O'Higgins was. He was assassinated. Yes, he was for his support of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, as was Michael Collins, but later than Michael Collins.
He was murdered, this member of the government, murdered by the IRA.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was pro-treaty.
And because he was pro-treaty, and also because he signed a lot of those death warrants. He was only 35 when he died. Just amazing. I'm not sure that we would have a 35-year-old vice president these days. It seems so young, doesn't it? But it was probably didn't seem so young at that time. So there we get Yeats's, in those two poems, I think Yeats's beliefs in Ireland both being challenged and reinforced in his poetry, struggling to believe at times, but ultimately seeing that not only was he believing not only that were he and his friends central to Ireland, but also that they were, that Ireland was central to his poetry. Lastly, that belief in something beyond the material world, and I'm just going to do this very, very famous poem, The Second Coming, from 1919. And here's where we get into gyres. Turning and turning in the widening gyre, the falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart, the centre cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dim tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, while the worst are full of passionate intensity. Surely some revelation is at hand. Surely the second coming is at hand. The second coming. Hardly are those words out when a vast image out of Spiritus Mundi troubles my sight. Somewhere in sands of the desert, a shape with line body and the head of a man, a gaze blank and pitiless as the sun, is moving its slow thighs, while all about it reel shadows of indignant desert birds. The darkness drops again, but now I know that 20 centuries of stony sleep were vexed to nightmare by a rocking cradle, and what rough beast, its hour come round at last, slouches towards Bethlehem to be born. What do you think Yeats's mindset was at that point in time? Feeling positive?
Very depressed.
Very depressed. His instigation for this poem was actually the Bolshevik Revolution. What does it say about ideas of class that might have been important to Yeats, do you think?
Well, he was of the Anglo-Irish aristocracy. Not aristocracy,
landowning, yeah, of that background, yeah.
And although he claims in that previous poem to be influenced by the soil, which presumably means the peasantry, that never really took as firm a hold on him as later events. I mean, Lady Gregory, obviously. And subsequent politics. And as you've already said, he was not for violence as a resolution. Although he did play an important part in politics, didn't he? He was a senator.
He was a senator, yeah.
He was involved in politics, but he didn't believe in the violent solution. So presumably, he didn't approve of the Bolsheviks overthrowing in violent means.
Well, he didn't approve of socialism. He certainly flirted with fascism.
He did flirt with fascism, yes, he did.
Leading the cycle of friends was Edward Hammond. So there is a political, and in latter years, of course, he did to some extent, I think, support the blue shift. So is that evident? He's not pacifist. I think it's arguable how much influence he has Hammond had.
Well, Pound was, do I remember this right? He was his best man at his wedding, wasn't he? Yeah, Ezra Pound. Yeah. So, in terms of his pacifist, when you say he wasn't pacifist, he hated the violence, I suppose, is a better thing. He thought there were better solutions than that. Would you agree?
Yes, he seeks order. The character order to be maintained, I think, is the... he wouldn't sympathize with the communists in a position of war.
It was 1919.
Wasn't it a time when everything changed after the war and the aristocracy suddenly realized that they weren't kingpin anymore?
Mm.
And maybe therefore the falcon... not hearing the falconer, who was in charge of the falcon at the time.
and it's a striking image, isn't it, that gyre and the falcon circling and gradually growing farther from the falconer. Escaping.
I was struck by the, just hearing it read, I haven't got it in front of me, but the very animal nature of the last bit. There's both the, is it the... man's head on
animal.
Lion's body, and then the thighs and the slouching to Bethlehem.
Mm-hmm.
Is it something about the animal instinct in the people? Maybe he's afraid that, as with the Bolsheviks, the more animal instinct to destroy and
there being blood and revolution is getting the upper hand. I say I'm just sort of from the way you've read it. Is that something?
And in his vision of the gyres and his ideas about the second coming and the world in 2,000 year cycles, he believed we were coming to a point of chaos, of a maximum chaos where it would all implode. And this rebirth is something monstrous. This second coming is something monstrous. And we might take that as an image of something sphinx like crawling across the desert, or it could be. He professed to have had a vision of this thing, this thing with the lion's body and the head of the man. Mm. And that idea of something slowly creeping across the desert. Yeah.
I'm not quite sure when it was written. Does it relate at all to the Black and Tan times?
It could very well. Yes. I mean, that would have been right at the time, because that was post World War I. Yes. Yeah.
But Yeats, of course, also had this the ceremony, everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. He had this rather weird idea of an Anglo-Irish perfect society, which was under Grattan's Parliament in the 18th century, taken away in 1800, and it was led by the Protestant ascendancy. And so we get to round about now a fascinating situation in Ireland. By now I mean
1920s. Yeah.
Where you have he refers in one of the poems to the streets, the wealthy streets and the poor streets at odds with one another, and mm-hmm. he feels that's because, of course, the IRA is coming up from the ordinary people of Ireland. He and Lady Gregory and his associates are very much on the literary side of things, all associated with Anglo-Ireland in the past.
Mm-hmm.
And this meant all sorts of ferments in his mind.
And we have to remember the people he mentions as the ideal revolutionaries prior to are all Anglo-Irish. From Fitzgerald and Emmett and Wolfe Tone, they're Anglo-Irish. It's never been a movement so much of the people before. This is a new development. And, of course, his own position is being threatened. I'll just end on that. I'm much better on the history than I am actually on the spirituality and the occultism and things like that on Yeats. But he did have very, very strong beliefs in these ideas. And as I said, he was searching for proof of them. And one of the means later on in his life, when he was in his 50s and got married, that he searched for these occult things was alongside his wife, Georgie Hydeleys, who, upon their marriage, he was in love with Isolde, or believed himself to be in love with Maud Gonne's daughter just before he married. She rejected his proposal. He was heartbroken, but he believed because of an astrological prophecy that he needed to get married in that particular year. And so he picked this woman who was in the Order of the Golden Dawn with him, Georgie Hydeleys, who was 25 years old. They got married. The marriage wasn't being consummated. Yeats still, in his head, very much infatuated with Isolde. And suddenly Georgie discovers this incredible talent for automatic writing. She's being given messages, and some of the messages actually kind of prescribed a certain amount of sex and in the marriage, and clever woman. But Yeats, he believed that thing beyond the spiritual world existed, but we can see that struggle to figure out quite what that was all through his life and all through his poetry. Any questions at all?
Would he have called himself a Christian or not?
I would say no.
No, I would say no from what I've heard, which is all that much.
Mm. He knew John Masewood, whose poet laureate, who was born here, of course.
Oh, right.
Yes, and they were both struggling with their spirituality, actually. So perhaps they had quite long conversations.
Well, a lot of people were struggling with their spirituality. When we think of Yeats, birth date, 1865, just post-Darwin, that offers a big challenge to Christian belief and biblical ideas. And so it's a tough time. And Yeats is a very interesting thing because he's a very interesting poet for me too, because he is poised between the influence of the Romantics and moving into into modernism and becoming very much a modernist. I think there are inflections of modernism there late in his poetry.
For the mystical element, it's the fact that he fastens it all in life itself rather than mysticism. You don't think of him as a mystic, do you? I don't. We don't.
Yeah, well, I came to know more about him than just his poetry through Catherine Tynan, who watched him, bang his head on tables and see at seances and things like that, and who he would write to her letters about, somebody having sat on the astral double of an Indian and couldn't see this astral double because he was too material. So he did have some silliness there in the beginning. He had some of that, but he... No. Exactly. That's what we want to know about him. Right. Well, I'll finish there. Thank you all for listening.